This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. It's the third Thursday of the month, the day for Computers and You, our monthly discussion about computers. Today, computer hardware and software. We welcome David Blair back to the program. David Blair is a consultant for RHI Consulting. He's joined us on many a Thursday over the years to advise us, to offer troubleshooting tips and advice on selecting hardware. He's also held a lot of hands walking us through problems we're not able to solve. Join the discussion with your questions for David Blair by giving us a telephone call in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else you happen to be listening, call toll-free 1-800-222-9455, 1-800-222-WILL. David Blair, hello.
Hello.
How are you?
So far, so good.
Good. Well, let's talk about computers. I would imagine that there are some folks out there who are thinking about buying a computer over the holiday season.
Let's get the tricky subject out of the way first.
Okay.
Y2K.
Oh. Well, okay.
I'm sure people are going to ask us about buying it, but I figure we get Y2K out quick and dirty, and then we can talk about buying computers.
Okay, why don't we go ahead and do that quick and dirty, because we have a caller waiting for us. Should we take the caller first?
Let's take the caller first.
Okay. Our first caller this afternoon is on line one. Hi.
Hi there. My question, sort of technical, concerns something I'm trying to do with scanning in a number of images.
Okay.
I've been working with the university sites, and the best scanner is attached to a Mac. It's a new G3. And I've been saving my images onto a zip disk that's formatted for IBM's, and I've been saving in an IBM-formatted TIFF file, or a series of IBM-format TIFF files, so that I can work on them on PCs.
Right.
And I thought I was getting a bunch of garbage added onto the zip disk by the Mac, and so I reformatted one of my disks on an IBM, and after reformatting it, I couldn't get anything that I saved on it from the Mac to be readable on the IBM. Is there some sort of file that needed to be on there that helps translate between the two?
Yes, I mean, Macs can read IBM formatted diskettes. IBMs and Macs have a slightly different file format.
Okay.
So it all depends on how you do it. But one of the best programs to get is from DataViz.
Okay.
And it's called Mac Opener.
Okay.
Or another one's called Conversions Plus, okay? Mm-hmm. Also, in the Mac operating system, they pretty much let you mount a PC disk. And when you mount a PC disk, when the disk gets mounted on the desktop, it'll say a big PC on it telling you that it's an IBM formatted diskette.
Right.
And that's the best way to do it. You format it on the IBM.
Okay.
And at the Mac, worry about writing to it. Now, you realize that TIFF is a bitmap format, so if you scan something in that's 4x3 in TIFF, that is the best resolution. If you want to scale it or small, you know, either up or down, TIFF is by far not the best format to use. You want to use a vector-based format like EPS or something else like that.
Okay. In terms of taking up memory, which is the EPS kind of format going to be more?
It's going to be bigger.
Okay.
But it's more flexible.
Okay.
So it all depends on what you want to do with it. So I'm like, if I take a snapshot of someone that's very clear, that is a wallet size, say, 2x2, and I want it to blow up to be 2 foot by 2 foot,
right?
If I blow it up in TIFF, it's going to be pixelated.
Okay.
So it's going to look like pointillism. Like the famous artist,
right.
It's going to show up as a series of dots.
It's going to be
you're
going
to have to be 20 or 30 feet away to understand what it is.
Okay.
Where if I do EPS, EPS allows, or similar vector-based format, draws it or interprets it based on mathematical lines. So it says this is an arc, this is a line, whatever.
Okay.
So everything is described mathematically. So when I expand it, you just put a multiplier on all the lines and arcs.
Okay, and
so it looks just as sharp at 2x2 as 2 foot by 2 foot.
What if I'm more likely to be compressing them slightly down?
EPS does the same thing.
It'll be still
whatever you start at, I can shrink it or grow it, and it has the same resolution as the original.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks a lot.
Well, thanks for your call this afternoon. Other calls are welcome. Here are the telephone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Anywhere else you're listening, call us toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. We're talking about computers today. Our guest is David Blair. Okay, Y2K.
There are several programs. Symantec makes one called Norton 2000 that costs money. There's a free one from the National Testing Software Laboratory. That's www.ntsl.com. That's www.ntsl, National Testing Software Laboratory. The cool thing about this site is that it has almost every major manufacturer on there as a link, and they use this site, then this company, to do independent testing for their products, Compaq, Dell, HP. All these folks use it. They have a product on there called, a program called YMark 2000. You make a bootable diskette, you load this program on it, you edit an AutoExec file, you put it on your machine, you boot it. And it goes through a series of dates from December 30th, 1999 to, I think, March 1st of 2008. So it goes through a series of dates. Checks every leap year, every September, every time that it could possibly be a change, it checks it. And at the very end, it'll print a summary saying, yes, you're compliant. No, you're not compliant. Mm. You just put in every machine and boot.
Okay.
So get that. And also, look at the website. So if you know if you have a Compaq ProSignia or a Dell Dimension or an HP Kayak, right there. You can go there and find out what's going on. And you can find the solution. Oh, yeah, you need to download an upgrade. Or, no, you need to do this, you do that. By and large, DOS and the old Windows 3.1 and below is not Y2K compliant. Now, let's understand what the difference between Y2K compliant is. There's several levels. And it's only going to affect programs that do date and time calculations. So financial programs, possibly email programs, things that determine date before one another. If you have a spreadsheet that's not doing date calculations, if it's just doing financial calculations, no big deal. If you're doing a word processor, no big deal. If you have a database with just names and contacts, no big deal. So the big thing that Y2K does is that if you're doing date and time calculations, that's why you care about the date. Because most computers are going to interpret 010100 as 01011900. They're not going to put a 20 in front of them. Now, some computers, they'll roll over properly. So when it becomes 010100, they'll keep on going. And it all determines whether internally they'll either put a 19 or a 20 in front of it. Some newer computers will put a 20 in front of it, so you won't know any difference. But they only show two digits in the century instead of four digits. So it all depends on what level of compliance you need.
Okay. The folks that you work with and folks you know and from your, you know, keeping up with the digital world, are we in pretty good shape, you think?
Depends on what industry you're talking about. If you're talking about the banking industry, the financial industry in America, yes, I believe we're doing very well. Now, if you're talking about maybe some more rural counties, maybe some poorer counties where they don't have quite all the resources, may there be fluctuations in the power grid? May there be some little snafu with checks? Sure. Is there going to be global catastrophe? No, I do not believe that. Now, if you have third world countries or you're in a third world country or more of a developing country, and especially the poorer or the more rural, that's when you're going to have more problems.
Yeah. Well, there have been, you know, some precautions taken. For example, the U.S. Embassy in Botswana is going to be closed for a period of time. And some railroads, I guess, major freight railroads and Amtrak will just stop the trains for a while. And they'll, I guess for the passengers on Amtrak, they're going to have, you know, a party.
Right.
Well, it's New Year's Eve, so that's appropriate. So they'll pull over and, you know, stop and make sure that everything is working properly.
Have you ever heard of the name Jane Garvey?
It rings a bell.
She's the new FAA administrator, FAA.
Federal Aviation
Administration. Mm-hmm. The people who rule the planes.
Right.
The federal agency.
Mm-hmm.
She's on her third flight booking to get a flight to fly on New Year's Eve. The first two are canceled. The airlines are having a major problem because people don't want to fly on New Year's Eve.
Right.
Well, duh. I mean, do I think planes are going to rain like flies? No.
Yeah.
Do I think there's going to possibly be some glitches in maintenance or scheduling? Yes. But I don't see any problems with the planes. But am I going to have my son fly on that day because my son's flying up to Illinois to visit his mother? No. My son is flying back on the 30th.
Yeah.
All I am personally doing is I verify that all my computers in my house are Y2K compliant. I'm getting out a little extra money. I'm stockpiling a little extra food. And I'm keeping tab of all my different bank accounts and whatnot. And I'm getting hard copies.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, just documenting what I got, a little extra food, a little extra money. I think if you do that, that's the prudent. Now, there are people who are building shelters and doing all sorts of craziness. I could be wrong, but I think that's just a little extreme.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about Christmas now.
Yeah, let's talk about something fun.
Okay.
What's gee whiz out there? I mean, if you go to any kind of Comp USA, Best Buy, you pick your favorite electronic retailer of choice. There's a lot of some pretty cool stuff out there. There's some genealogy programs that are pretty neat. Digital cameras are getting to where they're a dime a dozen. They've got new VCRs that are digital, high 8, which means you can download the video onto your hard drive, so instead of being on a tape, you can put it on a DVD. And that way it's going to hold up and it's digitized.
Mm-hmm.
The computer's getting better, faster, stronger. Intel released 23 new CPUs, central processor units, the Pentium 3s. They came out actually in February, but they came out with a new version for the mobile machines, but they need another support logic chip called the 820, which is in due for another couple of months. So you're going to see late winter, early spring, you're going to see 500 megahertz laptops right now. And you can see 400, 360s. Pretty soon you're going to see 500, 550. And you're going to see desktops in the 700 range real soon. Well, right now, most of them are seeing in the 400 to 500 range. So they're going to move to 700. The monitors, you know, are getting pretty blasé. I mean, a 17-inch monitor, $200 or $300, 19-inch monitors, all 5, 6. They got 15-inch flat panels for a grand, which is cool, but, you know, if you break it, it's awful expensive. So, I mean, if you worry about space or electronic emissions, all they're doing is they're taking a laptop screen, is putting it in a different case and allowing you to use it as a regular monitor so it's on the laptop. Mm-hmm. But it's the same technology, it's the same everything.
Now, prices have come way down.
Oh, yeah. Well, they do. They always do.
Are they likely to go lower?
Well, when the new CPUs hit, the current CPUs that are being sold today are going to be discounted heavily or won't be available. I mean, think about it. When I got in this business 13 years ago, which is like centuries in everything else business, 10 meg. Well, most machines were sold without a hard drive. And a 10-megabyte hard drive or 20 was like a godsend. Today, you're hard-pressed to buy a machine with a hard drive smaller than 4 or 6 gigabytes, which is 40 or 60 times bigger, or 400 or 600 times bigger. Now, the average person, you know, as I set up all these computers, you get a 6 gig or 4 gig hard drive, and you get all these programs loaded. If you really think about it, besides the programs, what is actually user-generated data, you know, letters, memos, spreadsheets, pictures, email, anything that the user has generated that cannot be easily reloaded from diskettes or CDs is actually a small fraction of the space being taken up by the average user. I'm not saying there's not people like me, the power users, that I've got more data than programs. But if you take a snapshot of the average person's computer, especially a home computer, by far they have more storage used up by programs than by files they've generated. But the problem with this is most people don't back up their data. If I'm a new user and I've got a 4-gig hard drive and I'm using 2 gig of it, and only, say, 200 meg of that 2 gig is actual user data, I've got a couple options. I can either copy it to a different part of the hard drive, so in case I do something inadvertent and delete a file, I can retrieve it real quick, or I can buy a zip drive. I can copy it to the zip drive, or I can buy a tape drive. Tape drives actually cost less than a zip drive. When you think about how much a drive costs versus how much the media costs, and they're real quick. But so many people, and I go to Best Buy and Circuit City and all these guys on a regular basis because I want to see what the average consumer buys. And, you know, I just see all these computers walking out the door and almost no tape drives walking out the door with them. Or they don't buy something like Norton Utilities. I have been using Norton for the last 12 years. Every time they come out with a new version, within a couple months I buy it because it fixes all these little problems I don't want to learn about. If my Windows machine starts acting up, I put Norton in there. I say, repair. There's a program called WinDoctor. It goes and analyzes all these different things, which I didn't ever want to know about. And it tells me, okay, yeah, you got a problem here, here. Fix it. And my machine works better the next time. I mean, this industry has gotten so big and so complex, there's no way, I don't care who you are, how smart you are, what kind of genius IQ you have, you're not going to know everything.
Yeah.
What you need to know is a few tricks so that if you get in trouble, you then need to know a friend to call, a company to call, a program to buy to fix your problem.
We've got someone waiting to talk with us. So let's go and talk with our next caller this afternoon on line one. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
I've got a question. It ultimately relates to using a CD-ROM rewritable drive.
Okay.
But I want to use it with a laptop. And it looks like the best way to do that would be with a USB card in the PCM CIA slot. I hope I got all those acronyms right.
You actually did. How old is your laptop?
It's about 3 years old. It's a Toshiba 205 CD.
2020, satellite 205?
Yeah.
Okay. So your machine does not have a USB port?
No, it doesn't.
How much is a USB card going to cost you?
Well, the only ones I've been able to find are 32-bit, and this has, I think, a 16-bit.
Won't work.
Yeah.
Let's go back. PCMSA.
Mm-hmm.
Personal Computer Memory Industries. I can't remember. What PCMA originally was for was a way to add memory to a computer. It wasn't meant to be the equivalent of a slot for a laptop. It has evolved to, or PCMCA, and is now called either PC card or card bus, has evolved into a way to basically have slots for laptops.
Mm-hmm.
And a slot can do anything. You can put a modem, you can put a network card, USB card, SCSI card, portable CD players. You can put almost anything in one of those slots. Okay. There's PC card, which is the old PCMCA called 16-bit. Then card bus is a new 32-bit standard.
Right.
Okay. Normally, if you have a card bus slot, it also can do 16-bit.
Mm-hmm.
But if I buy a card bus card, it only will work in a card bus slot. It won't work in a PC card slot.
Right.
So if you don't have card bus, and all you can find is card bus cards, then you're out of luck.
Well,
here's what I recommend instead.
Mm-hmm.
I just bought myself a CD-ROM burner myself. Yamaha makes a real nice one, either a 4x4x16 or 4x6x16. What those means is it reads at 6, writes at 4, and acts as a CD-ROM at 16.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So normally that's what the three numbers mean. And you want to get SCSI-based. On your laptop, you only have a 16-bit slot. You want to get yourself a Adaptec 1460A SCSI card. It's a PC card.
Mm-hmm.
It includes a product called Easy CD Creator, which is one of the best CD manufacturing programs out there. It'll make either digital CDs, computer CDs, or to make audio CDs. So you could take all your favorite CDs and take songs off different CDs or cassettes or wherever you get your music from, pipe it through the interface, and you can make your own mix on a CD that you can play in your car.
Okay.
The 1460 is going to cost you about $120, and the Yamaha external drive is going to cost you about $250,
$300. I see. Well, that wouldn't be
the too... reason why you want to go SCSI is it's got a faster throughput. The problem with USB, parallel port, anything else like that, you must maintain a very strict data throughput. When it's writing that CD, it has to write it at a certain speed, 1X, 2X, 3X, and the X means 150 kilobytes times X. So if it's a 1X, which are audio CDs, it's running 150 kilobits per second. If you're writing a CD at 2X, it's running at 300, or 4X is 600. If it ever drops below 600, or whatever the X factor you're running at, the CD is gone. It's trash. No good.
Hmm.
So you can never get below the X factor. So you do that, you can accomplish this by two reasons. One, you get a fast enough interface card that you'll never go below, and CD-ROM drive, you'll never go below the X factor, and you get software that's good enough that actually will buffer the data stream before it sends the CD so it never goes below the X factor. Because if it ever dips below, you're dead. Whenever I made CDs, most CD creation programs will allow you to test the interface and test writing first to see if it works. That way you don't keep on destroying media. And sometimes I'll actually let you dump it to the hard drive. So it'll make a copy from the source CD, dump it to the hard drive, and then from the hard drive it dumps it back to the writer. When you do it that way, when you write from the hard drive back to the CD, it's quicker because the hard drive can write the data out faster than a CD can. So if you only have one CD, like in your laptops, so you only have the burner, you'd put the source in there and you'd copy it from the source, the software would, to the hard drive, which means you got to have 650 megabytes free on your hard drive.
Mm-hmm.
Download the data, then it's going to take it from the hard drive and then write it out to the new burner. You're going to switch the disk, put in a writable disk, and it's going to write the data to it. Now, my laptop, it's got a built-in CD drive. So I've got one of these SCSI cards, and I plug in an external writer. So I've got both CDs at once. So I put the source in one drive, and I put the rewritable in the other drive. And it just copies the data.
Okay, that sounds good. I have a CD drive, too, in mine.
Right.
So, and for backups, it's writing directly from the hard drive, so there's no problem there, I assume.
Right. Well, but see, that's copying the data. I mean, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's a little different.
Yeah, it's essentially...
using a CD as a backup device is a rather expensive way to go. I mean, the discs now aren't that expensive, but you can't reuse it. Once you burn that, you burned it.
With a rewritable, of course, you could rewrite.
Right. Yeah, if you have an RW, yes, you could rewrite it.
Mm-hmm. And that was what I was thinking.
And that would be faster than a tape, but you're limited to 650 megabytes per disk. If you have a big enough hard drive, then you're going to chew up several of those disks before you fill it up. Get your machine backed up. That's why I like tape.
Well, tape is nice, but this seemed to be a more versatile way, and I doubt with compression factor built in, and if I have anything like the amount of data that I could put on a CD.
Most programs only compress at the rate of about 1.5. So, they don't compress real well. Programs do. Now, data, especially if you have any kind of Microsoft data files like XS, Excel, or Word, they compress greatly. I don't know how Microsoft does its file formats, but I have taken in the past a 12-meg Word file, compressed it down to 500K. That's a 24-to-1 ratio. That's a little excessive.
Mm-hmm. What about using something like PKZip?
I like WinZip.
You like WinZip better?
Yeah.
But it would be the same basic
file format. It's just WinZip has written their own engine.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this zip was settled a long time ago. Before Zip, there used to be Zoos and Arcs and TARS.
I remember.
And basically, Zip came out after Arc was being a pain. C, the company, was like Systems Enhancement Association or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And they were being a pain about it. So this, you know, PK, Phil Katz, came out with this Zip format. And it's now the de facto standard for compression.
Yes, I remember the Great Arc War.
Yep.
Well, that's a lot of information. So you would say go with
SCSI.
SCSI drive,
right,
and interface. And
because the thing about it, because once you have that SCSI interface, now you've got this flexibility. You've got a SCSI tape drive. You've got a SCSI scanner. You know, you've got a SCSI CD-ROM drive. You got a lot more versatility. You can make an external hard drive.
Yeah, and you, of course, can,
or
as you can with
drives,
USB, you can chain devices.
Right.
So you can get a number of them.
Up to 7.
Yeah. I guess
up
USB would get more, but you think the SCSI is a better interface for the purpose.
Oh, yeah. It's a lot more versatile.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much.
No problem.
Bye.
We've got some other callers waiting to talk with us. Our next caller is on line 2. Good afternoon.
Hi, David.
How you doing?
Good. I have a couple of questions about hardware. The first one would be, what would you think about buying a used, either Jazz or a Zip drive? What's the danger in that?
Well, the danger is on a Zip drive is the click of death.
The what?
The click of death.
Okay.
I am not making this up. There has been a failure of Zip drives and cartridges, and they've nicknamed it the click of death because once it fails, it starts clicking, and then it's dead.
Okay.
So they call it the click of death.
Okay. How about for a Jazz?
Now, I don't know if Jazz suffers from click of death or not, but there's if you go on iOmega's website, I-O-M-E-G-A, they talk about this, or if you go to another website by Gibson Research, I think it's grc.com, Gibson Research Corporation. Steve Gibson, which is a very brilliant man who wrote a product called SpinRite, which actually determines how well your hard drive's working and interleaf factor and does all sorts of gee-whiz stuff to hard drives, had a lot of users complain to him about the click of death. So he wrote a program that can determine if your Zip drive is susceptible to the click of death.
Okay.
Okay. Now let's get back to the question you're asking. Is it okay, or would you find it prudent to buy one of these? If you know the person, if you get some kind of warranty. Now, also, iOmega sells remanufactured Zip drives and Jazz drives, which would give me a little more of a warm fuzzy because they back it. The original manufacturer will back it with a warranty.
How do you buy those, through retailers or direct?
Direct from iOmega. It's like it's called iOmega Direct. You get on their website, and they've got a remanufactured section.
What's the discount factor on that?
I think it's like 30 or 40%. I'm just guessing. I don't remember off the top of my head.
Okay.
Now, remember, there's two flavors of Jazz drives. There's Jazz 1, Jazz 2. 1 gigabyte, 2 gigabyte.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the 2 gigabyte is much quicker than the 1 gigabyte drive.
Okay.
And now there's the new Jazz 250, which you can get in USB serial, no, USB parallel, or SCSI. If you get the USB model, it's very thin. I mean, it's about an inch tall or less. It's very light, and it's USB. I mean, USB is pretty cool. It's not as fast as SCSI. It's slightly faster than parallel, but it's very flexible. You know, most new machines, whether it's laptop or PC, have a USB port, or there's cards you can add to either a laptop or to a desktop to make them USB compliant. But you really need to have Windows 98, or you have to have OSR 2 on Windows 95 to support USB.
How about a Mac?
I think you got to have an iMac.
No, it's an old Mac, so it'd be just SCSI.
SCSI.
Okay.
Yeah. If you want to transfer between a Mac and an IBM, or all you care about is a Mac, SCSI is the only way to go.
Okay.
Now, if you have a new Mac, then you could do USB, but you said you had an old Mac.
Okay. And second question is a little more specialized. There's a product called Avid, which is a high-end video editing system.
Okay.
How how would you feel about somebody buying one of those used? What are the dangers? And when, or buying one new, how does that work when they come out with a new upgrade or product line, which they're doing now? How long would you have to wait till the old ones, you kind of see a price break in for those?
Well, let's go with the used one first. If you buy it used, as long as you have the original diskettes and they allow you to install it to make sure it works, you're okay. But the snag comes in is some companies won't let you transfer a license. So if you buy a copy used, that's all the higher they'll ever let you go. They'll never let you upgrade.
Okay.
If you buy it brand new, they'll be more than willing to let you upgrade.
Okay. On this, I think you pay $1,000, they examine it, they certify it, and then they'll support it.
Okay.
And then do you have to worry about the storage drives that they store the video in? Are those, since they're moving parts, are those more likely to wear out?
Sure. But the thing about it, if you're doing, it sounds like you're doing non-linear digital editing?
Yes.
Okay. With that, you need to get the biggest mamma-jamma system you can. You want to get high-end SCSI. That old Mac just won't cut it.
Mm-hmm.
You want to get, use a Mac. I'm just saying that old Mac won't do it. Get a new Mac.
Yeah.
Or get a new IBM. You want to have the latest and greatest SCSI system, and you want to get a hard drive that's AV rated. Audio-visual, so it's meant for multimedia, meant for doing nonlinear digital editing. So you want to get something with a SCSI 3 or Ultra SCSI 3.
Okay.
You know, wide. And if a hard drive doesn't specifically say that it's meant for AV, you want to get something that spins at the rate of 7,200 RPMs, preferably at 10,000 RPMs.
Okay.
Because the higher the RPM it is, the lower the access time, that means the faster the data stream is going to stream through there. Because just like I said on CDs, you know, you go below that. Nonlinear digital editing is okay once you have the files on the hard drive. It's getting the files to the hard drive and off the hard drive is the problem you have.
Mm-hmm.
Specifically, getting the files off the hard drive is the most problematic. Because you've done all this wonderful gee whiz editing, and you want to get your product out on the CD or whatever, or on tape. And if the data stream isn't crystal clear, isn't going through the pipe, unmodified, then the product you're going to come out is going to have bleeps or blips or hisses or popple or cracks. It's not going to work the way you want.
Yeah, usually on these, it by a turnkey system where the drives are supported by the company themselves, and give you telephone support, they only support their own drives, so you buy their drives.
And they do that just for the reason I outlined, because it requires such a specialized hardware to guarantee the product's going to come out properly.
Okay. Now, they're coming out with a new model early in 2000. How long would it take for the prices to trickle down on the old models, where the new users want to buy the brand new, and then they want to sell their old ones?
Depends on how well the new software is accepted.
Okay.
If the new software isn't quite as stable as they like, it's going to take it a while. But if the new software's got all these GWiz features and people are dying to go, I'd probably say 3 to 6 months. If it's not, it could be a year.
Okay. All right.
Okay.
Thank you.
Let's go on to another caller for David Blair, this one on line 3. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, David.
How you doing?
You mentioned Norton Utilities.
Right.
Well, I'm in the market for one of those programs that designed for people who don't know everything about computers. And I wondered if you could tell me how that compares with a couple of programs that have been recently advertised. One is Go Back, and the other one is Second Chance.
Well, they do completely different things.
Okay.
Go Back, let me see. I think Second Chance is, one of them is written by PowerQuest.
Yes, that's Second Chance.
Second Chance. And Go Back is written by someone else.
Wild Card. Yeah.
Okay. What they do is they keep a snapshot of your system, of all the configuration settings.
That's right.
So that if something happens, they say, okay, whoa, here, let's go back in time and let's put in these configuration settings.
Mm-hmm.
As far as I understand, they don't actually save files or back up files.
Okay.
They back up configuration.
Mm-hmm.
I actually have never used either one of them, but from what I understand, I've read the brochures and looked at the manuals.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they mainly do. They actually might save some data files, but they don't back up the whole hard drive.
Okay. How about First Aid 2000?
Like I said, I've been a loyal Norton user for years and years.
Okay.
I actually haven't tried First Aid. I used like a shareware version or a trialware version.
Yes.
It seemed like an okay product.
Well, yeah, I've used it a little bit, and it does essentially what GoBack does is it'll undo things that you've recently done that might have screwed
right.
your system up. But Norton Utilities is far in advance of any of those systems as far as fixing problems, right?
In my opinion.
Okay.
But I don't rely on Norton for everything.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, Norton's got like three or four great products that I use. They have some other things which I really don't like.
Yes.
I mean, the Norton Utilities, they got this Wind Doctor program.
Mm-hmm.
Goes out there and completely inspects your registry. I mean, every time I run it, every month or so, it tells me I got all these registry entries that are invalid, or I can't find this file, or I can't find that file.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes out there and fixes it. And normally when I run it, I notice my machine starts rebooting on me or crashing on me.
Yes.
I run Norton and it quits booting on me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, granted, there's no one in the world who will ever tell you that Windows 95 and Windows 98 are completely stable.
Of course.
Inherent instabilities. Windows NT is a lot more stable, but it's got instabilities.
Yes.
By far, DOS was the most stable, but it was the least complex of all these operating systems.
Okay.
So I get Norton Utilities. I use the Wind Doctor, the System Doctor, Speed Disk. Those are great.
Okay.
Now, the CrashGuard program it has, I'm not thrilled with it. I like McAfee on its antivirus. I use Norton, but I prefer McAfee.
I see.
So, I mean, I try and do best of class. I think McAfee's better than and Norton in antivirus. So I
okay.
use it.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks for the call. Our next caller is on line one. Hi.
Yeah, you mentioned the problem of the A20 chipset. I guess that's just for the notebook computers.
It's for any computer that's got a Pentium 3 that's using copper mine technology.
Huh. I thought it was related to AGP, the advanced graphic port as well.
That's part of it.
Uh-huh.
What it is on most of the Pentium 3s using copper mine, they're using the Intel 440BX chip, which is a support logic, which supports, the ISA bus, supports the PCI bus. You know, it's basically glue that glues the processor to the rest of the motherboard. So the BX chip, the 440BX chip, can't process all the signals as quickly as the 820 chip. So that ends up being the bottleneck.
Yeah, I've read in Tom's Hardware about the AGP and its vicissitudes, I guess one might say, that it's actually not on the ground, or in actuality it's not doing what it looks like it ought to, and it's because of this graphic call or something, and
right.
it was designed with this idea of having this incredibly fast memory in the chipset, the A20
right.
or something. But, I mean, I think some of the companies really took a big hit on this because they were ready to ship these, and then Rambus couldn't come up with enough of these fast memory things. But I'm just curious how this is sort of right at the leading edge, I guess, as right now. I don't know, but I'm curious about if you know anything about how the Mac side handles the AGP, because there are people that say that it would actually be rated as a 4x AGP given the bandwith.
But
I don't know how it handles these graphic calls and whether the memory is fast enough to actually really compete. But
well, if you think about it from a design point of view, a Mac has always been from day one a graphical based machine. The Wintel architecture, until recently, I mean, we're not talking very long ago. We're talking, 91. That Windows 3.1 came out. Think about it. Until Windows 95, and still even Windows 95, Windows 98, it's still not a true graphical-based system, because I defy you to get a Mac into character-based mode. Can't be done.
Well, that's not hardware, though. That's operating system, isn't it?
But that's part of it. It's part of the maturity.
Hmm.
I mean, it was all built by one company. Apple built the hardware, and they built the software, so it was a marriage.
Well, but OS X is going to have character format because it's going to have a Unix core kernel, I guess is what the right term.
But think about it. The way they built that, they built it so it was meant to be a graphical machine. So from day one, Macs have always been inherently complained, you're not the fastest, but you kill everyone doing graphics.
Mm-hmm.
You process graphics much better than anyone else in the world.
So
I think Wintels have caught up a great deal, but that's still the inherent weakness is, okay, you've got three different people at least in the graphics. You got one person making the motherboard. You got another person making the video card, and you got a third person making the OS.
Well, but Apple is using the Intel AGP protocols now, and I just don't know how fast they're supplying this library of textures, basically. Tom's Hardware has the wrap on it, and I'm still trying to figure it out. But
Well, I mean, Apple doesn't make the Motorola or the power chip.
Right.
I mean, they don't make chips. Well, they made a couple chips, but, you know, they didn't make, well, you know. But they take this graphic processor, they know what their OS wants to do with it, so they built the function into it.
Well,
it's not like we're in IBM, in the Intel world, you've got someone completely unrelated to the OS or the motherboard building that video card.
On another subject entirely, I heard that the local AT&T at home, or wherever it's being offered, that it's being offered through an Ethernet adapter to the USB port, and you said something earlier that made me wonder whether that's really a very good way to go with this. No. So you definitely want a card.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because the USB port is basically a parallel port on steroids.
Mm.
It is not as fast as a PCI slot, or as fast as a card bus, or as fast as PC card. It is barely faster than a parallel port.
Well,
it's rated to be much faster. When you look at it, a parallel port has got 8 lines of data running. A USB port is a
really, really high speed, like a printer and other accessories, scanner maybe, I suppose. But as far as how do you think it would operate on Internet connection, I mean, it just seems like it probably wouldn't be that satisfactory if someone was a high
user. Depends on what the slowest link is.
Mm.
If somewhere down the road, if you're going to a website and you go to 4 or 5 different websites and they have slow speed connections, I don't care if you're sitting at the supercomputer site there at University of Illinois and you've got a 1 gigabyte pipe coming right into your laptop or your desktop. If the website you're going to, somewhere between you and the website, is a slow speed link, that's the throughput you're going to get, whatever speed that link is.
Or there's a massive demand at all at once. The long lines definitely go slow, and they're usually more of the. So it may be that it's fast enough for the current current state of the web.
It's going to be faster than the serial port, your modem. Because I mean, when you compare the speed of a modem to a parallel port, it's faster.
But
hands down, parallel
but
port.
But that's not how anybody really is on a network. They're through Ethernet protocols, and I wonder if the Ethernet protocols take care of this. You said there was a necessary transfer rate or something, that it had to clock at a certain rate or whatever.
Well, that was for CD-ROM cards.
I'm going to have to jump in here because we're out of time, or very close to it. We're out of time.
Where it goes.
Yeah, it's 10 minutes before 2 o'clock. Well, will you join us next month?
Sure.
Okay. Take care. Have a happy holiday season.
I definitely will.
Okay.
Take care.
David Blair has been our guest this afternoon. He's a consultant for RHI Consulting.